and she Montefiore. Ain't that a shame? Anyone to blame?
Billy manages, he helps out, cares for the elderly, somewhat infirm, beloved old drunk of a musician, Socrates James Boudreau, 70-something, who knows and has worked with everyone. He's kind of like Billy's mentor, but would not even know what that word means. Soc, as he's called, is an unsung ancient hero of New Orleans R&B. Boudreau says he should have gotten royalties from all those Coasters records. He remembers a night in Asbury Park in 1963 where a very young Clarence Clemons shyly asked him for an autograph.
Sweet boy, the Stilly, he told me I inspired him. Listening to me taught him everything he knows, you know? If I had a nickel for every note that Clarence played, I'd be swimming in diamonds. Yeah, you right, swimming in diamonds.
One drunken night, Billy had to talk the old coot out of filing suit against Bruce Springsteen's charismatic sax man.
He's stealing my style, Billy. He's stealing my style.
Stones had a day off in Houston back in 99, and Keith Richards had never heard Boudreau play. Knowing that old Soc was not getting any younger, he figured this might be his only chance to see him, so he convinced Ron Wood to fly with him over to New Orleans for the Maple Leaf gig. As they got off the airline highway and they went down onto Carrollton, they had the driver stop at a store after Woody said,
"Keith, we can't show up without a gift. Let's get him a bottle of black. I hear he likes a little taste."
Not knowing Boudreau has difficulties when he drinks before a performance, Richards agrees, and they buy the whiskey. On the way to Oak Street, he opens the bottle and takes a swig. Ron Wood glares at the wheezy bastard. Richards says,
"I ain't had a drink since the plane, Woody,"
and he offers it. The Stones had tried getting Soc to play on Brown Sugar, but Boudreau was busy back then and couldn't do it. That was the closest they ever got to him. Dead Brian Jones was the one that turned them all into his growly blasts. No Englishman could play like that. It just blew them away. Ron Wood says,
"You're going to give this man, this legend, this icon, this founding father, an opened bottle as a gift? You selfish old dog. You disgust me."
And he grabs the bottle away.
"Well, we've sold more records than him, and he's half blind, Woody,"
Richard says.
"He won't even know. Come on, where's your swagger? We're the fucking Rolling Stones, man. We outrank him."
They sit quietly for a block, growling, fidgeting, snarling. Richard suddenly grabs the bottle.
"No," Woody says. "You're a pitiful slob, you drooling son of a bitch. You're a more disgusting degenerate than the public even realizes. You are a disgrace to the Empire, an affront to the Queen."
And Woody starts laughing and shrugging. Then he takes a long swig and grins his snaggly English grin, hands it to Richard. They both laugh their phlegm-tinged laugh,
at least a cracking and slobber,
coughing and laughter. Billy had met the Stones back in 1994 when Ivan Neville, the son of Aaron, opened for the Stones on their tour. That was our Mr. Silverman's very first taste of the biggest of big time. Billy was staggered by the way in which rock's royalty behaved. Surprisingly, Mick Jagger was a refined gentleman, wickedly funny and self-effacing. He could deal with him. Charlie Watts was civilized, intelligent, quite droll and sober. Ron Wood, when by himself, was an innocuous, unintelligible, chain-smoking dork. The others, Bill Wyman and Richards, he called lizards, and he has to muster his civility and fake a smile when he sees them now. The Stones' road manager had called ahead, and Soc wasn't sure who they were. He was pretty grumbly about that whole British rock thing because they stole songs from lots of his cronies that had been sort of swindled into signing their rights away. He thought he knew who they were, but was a bit confused, thinking that they had been the ones that had done House of the Rising Sun.
"All them Englishmen, they sounds alike, you know, except for that Tiny Tim." Yeah, you're right. Tiny Tim.
When Rock's royalty entered the venue, Billy was way in the very back of the patio. He had missed the scene when they came in, coughing and laughing as they praised Sock for that growly thing he's known for. They handed him the bottle, and what a smile. Sock surveys the scene, and he sees Billy's not around. He doesn't see his keeper. He does a 3 or 4 beat squonkle. You know that sound. And wide-eyed like a cartoon, shimmies and shakes like a dog who just got out of an icy pond, shouting, woo-wee! And 2 seconds later, Billy enters the room, none the wiser. Glad handing the wheezing distinguished English guest, Billy then helps Socrates get to the stage. He turns and he sees Woody tip the bottle towards Boudreaux in acknowledgement and offers a toast to
the undisputed king of growly sax, Sir Socrates James Boudreaux.
Then he hands the bottle to Richards, who chugs it and slobbers. And then at the microphone, Sock's grin explodes into that ridiculous drunken giggle of his and he says,
Boudreaux is in the house.
Waggles his finger, shaking his rear end like a goosed up Cab Calloway. Billy, scowling at him, knowing there's going to be some kind of mess he's going to have to make right, some absurd situation he's going to have to extricate this coot from again.
Again, Sock? You really did this? God damn it, Socrates! You're on your silly ass old man own. I quit! Take care of your own damn drunken self. It's your show, damn it, and y'all's the star.
Well, Boudreaux knew that Billy never meant it, and Billy, for all his bombast, knew he didn't mean it, too. Billy goes to the bar near the door and wants a cigarette. He's not had one since college, but oh, he is so tempted. He and his old boy, Leander, the head barman who has known Sock longer than Billy, wordlessly look at each other and mutually shake their heads, exchanging the most compassionate smiles imaginable. Then the set starts. Sock is playing while sitting down. When he was younger, he was known as quite the high stepper and showman. It was he that would choreograph the horn section's little moves. Dave Bartholomew would bring Boudreaux in to work with the group before they went out on tour. A lot of the doo-wop and Motown singing groups also got their moves from Sock. Anyone who saw Boudreaux play in the early 50s knows that it wasn't Chuck Berry that originated that duck walk. Socrates also wanted to sue him and the entire cities of Detroit, Memphis, and Philadelphia for stealing his stuff. However, he always admired Ike and Tina's show.
They's okay, that's them. Some East St. Louis kind of thing, not me. No, that's not me. East St. Louis, now that's a town. Did I tell you about Alva King and Miles Davis on stage together in 1947? Oh man, you're right.
On stage now for about 10 minutes, things are going just fine. He is sounding good, in fact, real good. As they head for the bridge on Sea Crew, Socrates stands up. He wobbles just the teeniest bit. He blows 8 bars of pure sterno blue heat and inspired, fueled by the 5 ounces of Jack Daniel's Black now fully entering his bloodstream, he thinks duck walk. He sinks low and he takes 1 slinky stride and he slips, falling backwards. He does not lose his note, mind you. And as he hits the stage, his foot kicks the crash cymbal right on the beat, while the force of his back end hitting the floor creates an unduplicatable squawk from his tennis saxophone. The crowd goes wild, struggling to stand. Sock bows. Willie Mae pats his brow and yells at him like an angry old granny. He's grinning like an 8-year-old that just got caught eating the whole cake, but he doesn't care that he'll be punished because he is so out there on the sugar rush and the adrenaline thrill of the theft.